Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, your hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. Big shout out to Shad throughout this last week as I was away for spring break with my family. So Shad took all the heavy lifting when it came to more news and more volatility, especially around that Fed meeting and statement. Because we've talked so much, at least in the last few weeks, about the banking sector, the Fed, just what might happen in terms of short-term market moves, I really think it's valuable to take a step back and look at big picture what has been going on with the economy, with some of the markets. We are also, though, going to touch on the banking sector. We are kicking off the show with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also editor of the Book Report website. That's where you can keep up to date with Peter in terms of market data, market moves, and anything else that's catching his eye, all geared towards the investor. Peter, I do want to get your thoughts on the at least initial failure of some smaller banks, except for that Silicon Valley Bank, as well as the Fed, the government, other governments also stepping into the banking sector to help shore up depositors, making them whole. When we take a step back from this, Peter, just how big of an issue are these cracks in the system for the banking system around the world?
Well, for U.S. banks, obviously mostly the regionals, you know, we're talking more about what the equity value is going to be for some of them. They need to raise capital, equity capital, and what the lending environment is going to be like. I don't expect really any more, or I should say many more, SVBs or signature banks where you have outright failure. Now, there is a question now that's very open-ended about whether uninsured deposits will be insured and it'll be just a blanket government coverage, you know, putting aside the philosophical debate whether that's the right thing to do or not. We're sort of in this gray area. And until that is answered by Congress, I think there's obviously going to be a lot of questions being asked. But I think it's less going to be the viability of these most of these banks and more so the hit to profitability via higher deposit rates, shrinking loan margins, thus less loan growth, and at the same time, as I said, equity raises to firm up one's balance sheet. So there is economic consequences to slow down in lending, and there's going to be an equity consequence for those that need to raise capital that way. Broadly speaking, you say global, to elaborate, you know, with Europe, for example, who they had a big sell-off in bank equity as well, sort of in sympathy. But I think there's less of an acute issue in Europe. But at the same time, 80% of the lending to business, both big and small in Europe, is done via the banks. So if they continue to tighten, and I say continue because they already started it, and the same is in the case in the U.S., there's been a tightening of lending standards, which you can only imagine is going to accelerate. So Europe's economy is at risk just from a slowdown in lending, and the U.S. economy will be negatively impacted as well. At the same time, we were already on the cusp of, you know, an economic downturn in response to the aggressive rate hikes.
Well, Peter, just in the along those lines that we were already setting up for some kind of a pullback or slowdown or contraction in the economy because of these aggressive rate hikes, and even if they were to pause the Federal Reserve and even other central banks and leave these rates higher, we still don't know what the overall effects are going to be. But in lieu of some of these banks holding bonds that they bought when they were a lot lower interest rate environment, and these rate hikes have caused interest rates to have got, you know, the yield curve got inverted, the 10-year, the 2-year, everything shot up so high so quick that a lot of them were sitting on problem assets when people pulled their deposits out. And that's really where some of these banking issues came from. People are drawing an analogy to the 2008 great financial crisis, but they seem a little different because that was about toxic debt and about, you know, mortgage-backed securities that really weren't worth anything. How would you compare this to the 2008-2009 Great Financial Crisis?
Well, I think that's right. That's where there's a huge difference, is that banks were loaded up on crappy assets, where right now the problem is more of risk-free assets of held to maturity, but duration marks that look ugly. You know, the irony is that the Fed probably has the most ugliest balance sheet, with about half the bonds that they own north of 10 years in maturity. But putting that aside, that is the challenge that these banks make. But, you know, the strange thing is that that's what banks do. They borrow short, they lend long. And they lend long in a variety of different ways, whether they're buying agency MBS, U.S. Treasuries, or they're lending money to a business. So there's always an asset liability mismatch that takes place at banks. The question is, of course, to what extent and what those assets are in. But, you know, in the banking regime that we have and the accounting standards we have and differentiating between hold to maturity and available for sale, and also just the confidence of one's depositors all come together in this sort of strange mix. We know that SVB was sort of unique in that it had a very concentrated deposit base and focused on really one industry, and that's what screwed them. I think broadly speaking, the rest of the banking sector has much more diversified deposits. So hopefully that there'll be a sense of calm that kicks in after the troubled ones figure it out one way or the other. And we can just go back to focusing on what the, you know, again, the profit standpoint, as I said, the impact is rather than the viability is of these.
So I want to circle around to something that you said, because it seems to be the consensus here is that lending is going to slow down, if not grind to a halt. How important is that to understand for investors in terms of where money will flow then? If lending is unavailable to these growth companies, do they have any hope?
Well, lending still might be available to some extent, but it just may be at, you know, a much higher cost. And when you think about, if you're in commercial real estate, a lot of these banks already have a lot of commercial real estate loans on their books. So they've been loath to further expand that business. They're just trying to figure out the legacy loans that they have. So at least that area, you're going to have to go to non-bank lenders in order to get loans in commercial real estate, but you're going to have to pay up for it. And there are going to be projects that don't take up, that don't get off the ground because the numbers don't work anymore, or you're going to have to pump up more equity. It's just the broad impact is going to be a slowing pace of activity. And those with strong balance sheets and liquidity are going to have a field day taking advantage of this.
So when we take this all into account, especially with the slowdown in lending, with the issues in the banking system, and with investors getting a little bit more defensive, is this all deflationary then in your eyes here, Peter? I know the Fed has wanted a disinflation environment, but does this all lead to deflation?
Well, maybe sooner, or I should say immediately, as the economy slows, but you know, we continue to have these bailouts. The Fed continues to, you know, has turned on the sort of liquidity spigot here as their balance sheet in 1 week got back to the highest level since last November. So it could be, but I think with the inflation debate, it's where it settles out at after this rate hiking cycle plays through. And if the Fed eventually responds by, you know, cutting interest rates and we can see a reacceleration in any downward trend on inflation. I think structurally speaking, the level of inflation is going to be higher. But yeah, in the next 6 months, can we get further fall in prices because the economy is further weakening? Yeah. But you know, to me, that would just be temporary disinflation rather than anything else.
Peter, you brought up an interesting point there about the Fed's balance sheet, because they have been on the tightening warpath for some time now. And they were really big on quantitative tightening and starting to, you know, shore up some of their balance sheet. But over the last few weeks, as they've backstopped some of these banks and have a facility available that could even further fund these banks, they've wiped out a lot of that tightening that they've done all in one motion here. What kind of effect do you think that's going to have on the economy and on the marketplace?
Well, I don't think much on the economy and the markets. I think that money is being raised by banks in return for handing over their agency and treasuries. First of all, it's only a one-year term. And I think these banks are just doing it to just satisfy any deposits that leave. This money is not going to be lent out at the businesses because it's going to have to be returned in a year. So I think this money is just sort of pull the lever if there's an emergency. That's what this is. So yeah, optically, the balance sheet's expanding again. But again, this money is, at least as of now, is going to have to be returned during a year. And I think it's just insurance money and to fill holes, deposit holes that may come up.
Well, Peter, over the last couple of years, we've talked a lot with a lot of our guests about the rotation from sector to sector. And we've seen from 2020 to 2021, where growth was reigning supreme, a lot of that money in 2022 shifted over to the value sector, where you saw more of an investment in utilities, consumer staples, healthcare. The financials were part of that, although I'm not sure how stable those are now. But even some of the commodities got a bit in energy. Now we're kind of seeing a bifurcated market where over the last couple of weeks, we've seen things kind of breaking some of those correlations. You know, we've seen some of the safe haven assets get more of a bid, a kind of a breakdown in energy. But even within the general equities, certain areas are doing well while others are not. How do you make sense of this, where we've kind of seen this overall rotation from one to the other into more of a choppy, kind of fragmented market now?
Well, in a way, it's been going on for a while. I mean, if you look back almost a year ago, the S&P 500, to use that as an example, has traded as high as 4,300 and down in around 3,600. Well, the 50% retracement of that is about 3,950. So that's what we've been doing for the last year, is just churning and churning and chopping and chopping and having this rotational type activity. Where last year the trade was to buy energy, sell tech. Recently it's sell energy and buy tech. So that's just a characteristic of markets for a while. I still think the overall trend for many of these groups or some of these groups will be lower, but sort of tight time frames, you know, you get these algorithmic rotations that tend to be violent at times.
So, Peter, you mentioned energy and last year how the trade was out of tech into energy, at least for the first half of the year. Let's talk commodities, but let's start with energy again. Do you see the health of, let's say, oil or natural gas still sticking around? Or are you thinking that maybe those will drop along with as everything else slows down?
Well, we've certainly seen a sharp pullback already as the optimism about a demand increase from China has been offset by worries about a recession in the U.S. and slowdown in Europe. So it's sort of this tug of war. I still think over the coming years, oil prices are going to go much higher, but I certainly have to respect the concerns about a faltering in U.S. demand for sure. I still think that you know, over the coming year, China's increase in demand will overwhelm that. But yeah, I understand the pullback, but I still think that the sector is pretty attractive, as are the stocks.
Well, let's also talk about the precious metals. Over the last couple of weeks, they have garnered a bid in light of some of the flight to safe haven, along with bonds and with the yen. So just curious what your take is on how the precious metals are setting up for the balance of this year.
Well, when you think about the two biggest points of bearishness over the past year, is the Fed's so aggressive in raising interest rates and the dollar's been strong. Well, the Fed is about done raising interest rates, and the dollar peaked last September and is now rolling over. And of course, now you have Fed's balance sheet increasing and what that means for potentially the dollar, what rising U.S. debts and deficits mean as a headwind for the dollar. And I think this, and I've said this before, so I'm guilty of being wrong in terms of my timing, but this is the kind of environment that that gold and silver could thrive.
What are your thoughts on these critical minerals? Because boy, oh boy, they're in the news a lot. Government seem more supportive of them, even shoring up big pools of capital for them. We've even seen on our site generally more interest in these sort of, and they're not new metals, but they do have this new interest in them. Do you think that this is a sustainable trend, that these critical minerals are truly in a bull market and money will stay available for them?
Well, I think all we have to do is look at the government's goals for EV usage and other renewables and the closure of coal plants and so on and so on. And that it's an impossible dream to be realized unless we get our hands on a lot of these materials. So I see for sure a lot of money that's going to be invested in whether it's lithium or copper or cobalt or nickel and other things that are going to be needed to power this new sort of, you know, energy utopian world that many want us to accelerate to.
Well, based on those comments, Peter, are you seeing the commodities in general as still part of a larger uptrend? Or do you think a lot of the move we saw in 2022 got overly exaggerated due to the Ukraine war? I mean, what's your outlook, I guess, more in the medium to longer term for the commodity sector, barring some short-term volatility?
No, I still think that the trend is up. I still think that there's major supply challenges for a bunch of these different metals, some more than others. Demand is going to be temporarily impacted by a slowdown in the economy for sure. But when looking out over 5 to 10 years, there still seems to be a big mismatch between the demand that is needed relative to the supply that can be found.
Then are you interested in sticking to the larger commodity markets because they are more established? Or do you like these growing commodity markets because of the potential increase percentage-wise in demand?
I mean, I'm sticking to some of the bigger ones, you know, whether that's copper or nickel, that I think is are two really attractive industrial metals in particular. But, you know, it's as we know, the mining's a tough business, and a lot of the mines were in not the most hospitable places, and you have to you know, weather a bunch of price volatility, particularly what we're seeing now.
Well, just maybe one more on the commodities that kind of ties more into the energy side, Peter, and that is that we, you know, we give a lot of time to oil and nat gas, and rightly so, it's a huge market. But there's other aspects of the energy sector like nuclear for uranium or the renewable sector with solar and wind and hydro. And you still have nat gas as being an important component with nat gas plants if you're converting coal plants. Is there any area of the energy sector that you're more bullish on than other aspects, or what's your take as the overall energy picture?
I'm pretty bullish on uranium. I've been for years, and I remain so. Nuclear certainly is getting a lot deserved respect, as it should, in light of everything that's gone on over the past year plus. And I still think that there's a major supply-demand imbalance over the next 5 to 10 years in uranium, and I'm bullish and we're long.
Okay. Peter, I guess final comments then. Big picture, what matters for the rest of this year? Is it economic data? Is it the banking sector? Is it what central banks do? How are you going to balance out everything for the remainder of this year, which is quite a long time?
Well, it's all of the above, because we're living in a higher cost of capital world that just got even higher in light of what's going on with the banks. And in a credit-dependent, interest rate-dependent economy, this just naturally is going to slow the demand for borrowing, will slow the supply from lenders, and you're going to see slower economic growth until this economy can build up greater savings, both at the household side and the business side, that can rely more on equity than debt.
Okay, Peter, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts here. Again, kind of taking a step back from all this day-to-day action that we get bogged down with. There are some big picture themes that have really come to light in the last year and a quarter, let's call it, that do need to get noted because it is, quite frankly, a very different market environment. Peter, thank you as always for your time. If you want to keep up to date on what Peter's following, what he's writing about, you need to check out the book report, which I will link to in the weekend show posting. Peter, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.